the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina. It's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax. But buckle up and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. I'm here with my co-host, Brooke Medina. We're going to jump into the North Carolina primary, particularly for president. For both parties, of course, you got Donald Trump, the Republican Party, and a host of candidates for the Democrats, with Bernie, Biden, and Sanders as the front runners here. So, Brooke, how's it going?
It's going great. We are so happy to have you back. The audience has missed you. I know it. And I've missed my hallway buddy over here. I mean, you and I have offices right across from each other, and it's been awfully quiet down here since you've been gone. So welcome back.
Well, thanks. I'm glad to be back. It's always good to come here in the office because it's a lot of good people that work here, and they're fun to chat with, fun to talk to. And
you know, I'm the most fun.
You are usually right? The most fun. Usually. I mean, Carrie and Libby always have some good like inside scoops, I feel like.
Okay, Ray. I see how it is.
I'm just telling you, they got some good skills. And you know, Bob, he's always got something.
Yeah, Bob is great for Catholic history news, sociological takes on things.
Yeah, pretty much anything, really.
Yeah, he knows it all.
So I just got back from a vacation with my family. Traveling with the 1 and 2 year old, I feel like Kelly did a lot of the work. And of course, we had my parents on the way down and on the way back, so that was a lot of help. But still, I mean, we have a child that's 16 months, Henry, who's like way too big to be a lap baby. He's like a giant baby.
Oh, yeah, he's so cute and chubby.
Yeah, he's very cute. And both kids are really good travelers, but just traveling with the 1 and 2 year old, a 3 year old, James just turned 3, by the way. He's now saying he's 3 and a half already. I mean, it's amazing how a couple days after their birthday, they announce themselves, well, I'm 3 and a half, so.
Yeah, and we're just like, okay, I'm, you know, 3 days less than 40 or something like that. I mean, like, we're always trying to make ourselves younger than what we are, or
Yeah, 39 plus 3 days. A half is a big deal, I guess, when you're in your early single digits.
It is. My kids are always trying to push that, except for my oldest. She's 16, and so she's happy with just saying, I'm 16.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so how was the trip?
Yeah, it was really good. We went down to Cayman Islands. My father-in-law's got a rental property down there, so we just basically had to pay for airfare.
Nice.
So we flew on Southwest, and it was a very good experience all the way. I've had a lot of bad luck flying lately, so going on Southwest.
Yes.
Everything went pretty smoothly, and so that was a blessing, and it was just a lot of fun. It's a great – I'd been there once before. It's a great island to visit. People are very nice. It's a British protectorate, so obviously it's very safe, and the snorkeling's great. It's just fun to be out at the beach. I had a good time, and looking forward to go back maybe in a few years.
Yeah, well, and you all did not contract the coronavirus, it seems.
No.
So good job.
At least to my knowledge, no. We
should be quarantined, actually.
There were a lot of people wearing masks, though, in the airport. And I was like, man, should I be wearing a mask? But then I read on the CDC, I think it was the CDC site, that masks weren't necessarily the best preventative measures. I mean, it's maybe better than not wearing one, per se. But really, the best thing you can do is just wash your hands vigorously and you know, routinely. That's much better preventative maintenance than sort of just wearing a mask.
Yeah, well, you know, there's something, there was a CDC warning making its rounds on Twitter, and it talked about how if one is going to wear one of those coronavirus preventative masks, that a male should not have a beard while he's wearing it. And so I've decided my husband's just going to have to go under house arrest until after the virus blows over, because he's not shaving his beard.
Yeah. So. And I think to me, it's a little bit disappointing to see some of the panic. Obviously, the CDC and all the scientists and medical professionals need to be prepared. But to me, there seems to be a little bit of a panic going on in terms of how serious this could be. It potentially could be serious, but it's it's not quite yet. And I think if we get into this warmer season and people keep washing their hands and just doing some precautionary measures, that I don't think there's a reason to panic per se and go out and like buy bunches of stuff and hole yourself off in a shelter or anything like that.
Yeah, but definitely take precautionary measures just like you would in terms of even preventing the flu. But I do have some friends in South Korea, and she's been posting on her Instagram. They have 5 children there. Her husband's a federal contract worker over there. And she said that, you know, they're wearing their masks all the time whenever they are out, but they've canceled all outside activities at this point in time because I think around 1,700 people have been infected with the coronavirus over there. And so I can only imagine it's really challenging with kids, especially.
It's people who are immune compromised, especially, which would be older generations, maybe people who are on immunosuppressant drugs, and then also young people. So, there's certainly some concerns, but I think for the general healthy population, a total freak out is probably not in order yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Agreed. Remain calm. Except my husband. So I don't know if do you follow the Enneagram at all? Like, have you done any research on that?
Not really. I've heard of it.
Okay. So it's fun. I love personality tests. I know some people think they're bunk, but I appreciate them. And so my husband is an Enneagram 6, which is called like the loyalist, and right, they're very security oriented. And so he's off of work today. And so he's decided to spend his day going to Costco and other places to get non-perishables and freeze-dried foods and tons of water, because he just likes to be super prepared.
Well, I will come to your house. My family will come to your house if there's a prepper emergency and we need, because I'm not that prepared, at least at the moment. So,
okay, yeah. Noted.
Well, we're a family that tends to get groceries like 3 days a week, you know. Okay. We don't have stuff stockpiled.
Yeah, once the boys get older, though, you're totally going to be going to Costco, and then you could probably shop once.
Well, I'm going to tell you what. Henry is about 16 months, and I've never seen a kid eat so much. He out-eats me sometimes at dinner. It's insane. It's like if he'll just go from plate to plate, like cleaning off everybody's plate. I mean, it's amazing.
That's hilarious. And,
yeah, he's just so tall, too. It's not that he's fat. He's just tall. And it's fascinating to watch. And it makes me dread, like, by the time he's 12 or 13, what our grocery bill is going to be.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure you can speak to that because you have.
Yeah, you better start saving now. No, my 13-year-old is massive. He's like 5'9" already, maybe 5'10" now. And he can eat an entire frozen pizza by himself and then still want more food. So, yep, we shop at Costco quite a bit and have to buy things in bulk just to feed him. And even my tiny 16-year-old daughter, she still eats quite a bit. She's a growing teenager. So
I miss the days you could eat whatever you wanted, Brooke.
Well, I guess we need to dial back our Reese's milkshake visits at PDQ right around the corner.
Yeah. You told me about the report, I think today, that 42% of Americans are obese.
And 9% are extremely obese. That is sobering.
Yeah. When I was down there in the Cayman Islands, I noticed like Americans getting off the cruise ships, and you could kind of tell. I mean, Americans, you forget about it over here as much, but they're just so much bigger than, you know, Europeans or locals over there. It's just very noticeable in most instances.
Yeah, I think that we really need to grapple with our eating habits. And I think some of it might come from, and this is purely, you know, conjecture. I'm just kind of shooting from the hip here, but I do wonder, we're very work oriented society that values lots and lots of work and many hours at the office. And so I think a lot of times we put health in the back seat and we look for convenient foods and comfort foods. And so having a right relationship with food is something for our own health, so that we can stick around and take care of our kids. It's something that we need to think about.
Yeah, watch out for the high fructose corn syrup. I think that's a problem here in the U.S. It's in everything, and it doesn't need to be. I know it's cheap. It's subsidized by the government and all that stuff.
Well, that's the thing, brought to you by the corn lobby,
yeah,
right?
Exactly, right. And, you know, notice that, you know, just having going out to eat in Cayman Islands and a few places, you'd order something and it's not as sweet. There's just less sugar in things that you, you know, like a even a lobster bisque that I got over there, it was less sweet than you would have had over here in the United States.
Yeah, we definitely do high fructose corn syrup, just about anything we can, and sugarfy it. But there's some good alternatives out there nowadays. You just have to look for them. But anyways, that could we should actually do an episode on sort of how the government has distorted some of the food markets.
Oh, for sure. Oh, yeah. There's no doubt about it. I mean, it distorts everything it gets its hands into. I mean, you know, kind of dovetailing off, like, just because I was thinking about this so much, just because it's an issue in the campaign, the student loan stuff, it's amazing how the government has just basically destroyed so many lives just through the whole student loan borrowing programs. The aspect that they allowed people to take out that much in loans should be criminal.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And
sorry, I have a cough. I know that's bad podcast, but I don't think it's corona, but I still have a little cough lingering.
Oh, no, you better keep your mouth covered. Vampire cough. No, but actually that is a nice segue into what we are going to be talking about regarding Bernie Sanders. However, you know, when it comes to the student loan crisis, we see him and a number of other politicians talking about reparations for those that are in student loan debt and or those that have been victimized of that and have paid off their loans. But ultimately, all of these solutions are government-centric without being honest about the fact that government created a lot of these problems. And so who in their right minds actually thinks that government's going to be able to solve the big mess that they've already put us into, whether it was the housing crisis, the student loan crisis, or many, many other things?
Yeah, one of the interesting things in this campaign is, and I agree with Sanders to an extent on this, is he brings up the point that Bloomberg's trying to buy the nomination. But from another perspective, Sanders, maybe even worse than any candidate, including Warren, is trying to basically buy voters with taxpayer dollars. I mean, it's absurd with some of the proposals that he has out there. I don't remember the actual number of years, but he's basically proposing $60 trillion in new spending when we're $23 trillion in debt with all kinds of obligations that we just can't afford. It's insane to be throwing out that type of spending proposals. If anything, we should be dramatically cutting federal spending and trying to shift more emphasis to the states in terms of just whether it be social programs or management of resources of tax dollars. And to me, it's just insane the amount of spending people are throwing around. And this includes Trump as well. This includes the Republican Party for many years and generations. So it's not just an indictment of the Democrats. But to me, I just seeing these numbers, there's no way to grow out of this. There's no way to punish the wealthy, because the wealthy will always find ways to shelter some of their tax dollars.
They'll just move. They'll eventually move.
Or they'll become more expatriates and just go to places like the Cayman Islands or go to Ecuador. I mean, I know a family that, you know, retired and went to Ecuador. You know, it's just those opportunities are going to be out there for the wealthy while the rest of us are going to be left to hold the bag. And it's just disastrous to me. The economic illiteracy broke in this country is insane, that people are considering Sanders as a viable presidential candidate when the stuff that he's talking about is like recycled Marxist philosophy that even some of the Marxist countries, even the Soviet Union started to try to move away from this at the end with their perestroika reforms and another type of, you know, China at least tried to introduce some market freedoms within their population. So to me, I mean, it's insane that he's got a cult following with this, but it kind of shows the economic illiteracy of a large segment of the nation. But I think it just shows a lot of people that are disaffected with both parties, because I think Sanders draws from people that are just sidelined by both parties to a degree, much like the rise of Trump certainly wasn't necessarily a Republican phenomenon. It was a phenomenon of people being forgotten. And you see that with Sanders too, but just the economic illiteracy that people think that stuff is actually free.
Don't you think that's an indictment on our modern education system?
Yeah, and it was a piece I published today. Tim Hall, who's the director of academics at Thales, made this point in the piece that socialism is an attraction to a lot of young people because we rely so much on a mode of reasoning, that we reason with our emotions and not with, you know, a logical mind in terms of critically thinking through issues because of a mode of reasoning with a lot of young people. And it's an indictment of the public schools. Public schools do good, some good things, but they don't do sort of this classical model or reasoning real well with a lot of students. And it's created this notion that people can't really think. Instead, that they sort of emotionally respond to something. And it sounds good, Brooke. It sounds good to be promised free stuff. I mean, if you offer me free things, yeah. I mean, if I don't know any better, if I don't know how the economy works, if I don't know that we have a monumental debt crisis and it's going to punish us and our grandkids, and if I think things are going to be free, then yeah, I'm listening.
So I wonder though, because of course we've identified there's this education gap when it comes to economics and civics, which has created this vacuum for populism on the left and right to fill, but also this growing acceptance of socialism, or at least maybe more a growing apathy toward it. So it's not looked at with such disdain as it was when you and I were growing up and younger. But I just wonder what the remedy is at this point in time. I mean, I think advancing the school choice movement is something that that we work on here at Civitas that can be done at a state and local level, where parents can choose schools that that will educate their children and give them some solid civics education. But when you're talking about parents that maybe haven't even received that sort of education and it's not on their radar to look for it, how do you usher in this broad societal change where we once again realize that it's things like capitalism that are great wealth equalizers, or at least they provide the opportunity for someone to advance and become maybe one of the one percenters?
No, that's a great point. I think, you know, when you think of it like that, I mean, we haven't really had a socialism free market debate or capitalism, whatever you want to call it. I tend to like the term free markets just because markets are a reality. And so to ignore them is to your own detriment. But I think if you're looking at it that way, we haven't really had a capitalist debate really since the Reagan administration, but we were looking at socialism more externally in terms of, you know, socialist countries abroad or totalitarian regimes abroad. And now it's such an insular part of our nation with so many young people and such a cult movement in the United States that we're having now this debate here because so many people have forgotten the lessons from the Cold War. And I think to a degree is, there's just no memory for a lot of people of how monumentally grotesque was the economic collapse in these socialist and command economy regimes, and how people starved and how people couldn't get food. And it's ironic, Brooke, because we live in the richest nations in the world, and that's because of markets largely. I mean, there's some cultural factors to that too, but it's largely the free market, and yet people want socialism. So it's this weird dichotomy or contrast that you have. And in a way, it's like, you know, we live in a probably where the Bible is more accessible than any time in history, but we're also probably from a United States perspective, the most biblically illiterate, you know, generation, mm-hmm. you know? So you have these contrasts, and it's very intriguing. And yeah, a lot of it's just a lack of education and a desire. I think for some people, honestly, they don't want to think through some of these deeper issues and they want a caretaker. And for them, look, I see the appeal. People that bash these people and say they're stupid, they're not stupid. Young people aren't stupid. I've met a lot of young people. You know, I've led some small groups with young people. I've talked to young people. They're not stupid at all. And so I think that if you're $150,000 in debt, you don't feel like you have the same opportunities as your parents did. You can't go out and buy a home. You can't buy a home for most young people in this, you know, market like Raleigh, especially. You don't have the opportunities your parents have. You don't have an opportunities at pensions and things like that. You feel left behind. You feel like you don't have a resource to get ahead. And so I get why it's appealing, Brooke. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, but I think that a lot of the information that leads some of the younger generation to feel like they're not ahead, granted, the student loan quagmire is a very real reality, but I think some of the numbers that often get touted in the media, they want to kind of cast shade on the economy because they don't like who's sitting in the White House, makes it seem as if we're, you know, that there is just such unfavorable conditions for younger people. And I'm not entirely sure that's the case, but that's kind of the narrative that they've been fed. But when you think about, let's see, just purchasing power and the amenities and the technologies and the accessories, the food, all of these things that are so much more affordable for people these days than they were even two decades ago. And so I think that needs to come into the equation so that younger people can also feel some sense of optimism about what their future holds. There still are some very real realities that we need to grapple with on the student loan front, declining birth rates, that's something that should be addressed. But at the end of the day, I think that there's also a lot that we can celebrate and a lot of progress we've made, especially when it comes to employment numbers the opportunities for us to enter into community with other people.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. There's still a lot. I don't want to make it seem like there's not a lot of opportunity out there, but I do think there's a segment, you know, if you major in gender studies or philosophy and you're coming out of college with, you know, $100,000 in debt, then you just feel overwhelmed. But there's certainly a lot of opportunity out there. And you're right. I mean, the market has created situations where products and goods are less expensive, that they're much more attainable. I mean, who would imagine these giant TVs? They're very attainable, you know, even in poor, very poor homes. I mean, you walk into a home and it's obviously low income. And you can argue if this is good or bad, but I mean, you'll see these giant TVs and other, you know, tablets and things like that. And could you imagine, 18th, 17th century, the poor people had no idea of the kind of luxury that, you know, mm-hmm. poor would have today.
Yeah. And even the affordability of clothes and shoes, things like that. I mean, I can go online right now and I can see on Instagram, I can see these ads for like $7 dresses. And these are ones that just, it would be very uncommon to find such a huge variety of clothing at such an inexpensive cost. So anyways, I mean, but nonetheless, none of these things are things that can actually buy someone real contentment or satisfaction. Nope. Those come from strong institutions. And I would say there is definitely an institutional poverty that we have here in the country, from the family to the church to civic institutions. Private business still is doing well. We've created, you know, the government has allowed for a more thriving business environment to flourish by deregulation and occupational licensing reform. But when it comes to a lot of the more sociological institutions, that's where we're really, I think we need to turn our attention there before we start, you know, promoting new government intrusive programs.
Agree 100%. There's a dearth of these quality organizations, quality civic groups and community involvement. And, my wife works in higher ed and I know she deals with a lot of mental health stuff. And you see that rising, particularly with people. There's a crisis of loneliness with a lot of young people, but just people in general. I think it's not just young people. I think it's just a general makeup of society now where people are just less connected, even though, you know, they think they're more connected digitally or they seem to be more connected digitally, but they're much more isolated, within the four walls that surround them in many respects. So it is sad to see, and you're right. I mean, you're exactly right, Brooke. I mean, if we're going to use resources and we're going to use kind of momentum, I'm not necessarily talking about tax dollars, but momentum and a push to solve problems, it has to be with charitable groups. It has to be with civic-minded organizations to meet these kind of needs that really aren't, can't be solved by material things, whether they come from, you know, the private sector or government or a huge salary or things like that nature. It has to be met in other ways, I think, for society to heal and to be holistic on the whole. So that really is the crisis. So getting back to the topic, because we dovetailed a little bit, what do you think is going to happen here Tuesday in this big primary in North Carolina? You got, I guess, Bernie's in South Carolina Saturday. So if Biden can win that, where he's pulling ahead, will that carry over into North Carolina, where Biden can start picking up some momentum and maybe turn the tide on this Democratic race, where he becomes the front runner again, and Bernie Sanders is kind of, you know, not on the periphery, but he's sort of trying to play catch up again.
Right. Yeah. So I've heard some pundits offer up some analysis when it comes to the Bernie phenomena. I don't know what to call it, but you know, Bernie has a very loyal following, but I'm not entirely sure it's something that will actually become more expansive than it already is. Perhaps if he were to gain the nomination, there would be some, fence straddling Democrats that just decided to pull the trigger for Bernie. But I think it would alienate a lot more of those center ones, and they'll go for Trump. That's my guess, at least. But I think Biden is going to be able to catch some steam if the South Carolina polling is any indication. So by the time this podcast airs, we'll already know the winner of South Carolina. But as of right now, the polling indicates that he's got 40%. So I think that would be some definite steam going into Super Tuesday. But if he loses in South Carolina, one would wonder how much longer.
Yeah, I think he just got the endorsement of Congressman Jim Clyburn. I think his name's Jim. His last name's Clyburn, but he is a prominent African American figure in South Carolina and congressman. So that's going to be a big boost to Biden. I actually was surprised he didn't have it already, but maybe it was just more of a formal ceremony, and so that will probably help him. I think he'll win South Carolina. I don't necessarily means that he'll automatically win North Carolina, though. Certainly Bloomberg, according to Civitas polls, Bloomberg, Biden, and Sanders are all sitting at about 20%. It'll be one of them. And I think it's most likely, honestly, if I had to pick right at this moment, I think it could be Sanders. I think Sanders has an advantage like Trump had, is he's anti-establishment. And that helps him, I think.
That's an appeal for sure.
I think it's appeal because, like you talked about, these organizations are withering away, and people don't want to be seen as Republican or Democrat. And I think that plays to Sanders' advantage as an independent. I mean, he's been a long style socialist who has caucused with the Democrats. And he's you know, as people have seen and read in the news, if they didn't know already, he's coddled many of these Marxist regimes throughout his history. I think it's an appeal that he's seen as an independent voice, kind of an insurgent candidate to some degree, even though he's ran before for this Democratic nomination. And I do think if I had to pick today, I think I'd maybe small edge to Sanders, maybe Biden, and then Bloomberg in third. But, you know, according to Civitas polls, it could be any of those three. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, it will be interesting. What do you think about some of the other races that we've got going on? Let's say that, well, Cal Cunningham and Erica Smith are both running for Senate to go against Tillis. Seems like Cal Cunningham's going to win that one.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, at least the poll, he's the establishment candidate. You know, he's at least from a Democrat perspective, is a little more moderate than Erica Smith. So I think that he, being the establishment candidate, should win that primary. I don't expect some late surge from Erica. And then, of course, lieutenant governor race, there's like 8 Republicans or something. I haven't followed that real closely. The local races for everybody in their counties and such. So it's really going to be – all the focus is on the Democratic primary here, and Super Tuesday, of course, where – I don't know if it's 20% of the delegates. I can't remember, Brooke. Maybe you know offhand, but it's a good chunk of the delegates, and maybe not quite 20%, but finally a substantial chunk of the delegates are at stake now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So I don't know the number either, but you know, we've got our finger to the wind right now here at Civitas, and we're going to be running several other polls leading up into the primary on Tuesday. But then after that, it's definitely, we're going to start polling with a lot more focus and intensity toward these actual races, the Democrats versus the Republicans. Right now we're focused on primaries, but it's going to get interesting. We actually have a poll lunch coming up on March 26th, where we're going to have some very interesting findings. So if you go to our website at nccivitas.org and click on events at the top, you can purchase your tickets there and join us at the poll lunch.
Yeah, and come to CLC, which will be in April. My birthday, you can come and celebrate my birthday with me at CLC. I can't that would think be of wonderful. Any other better reason to go than that, Brooke.
What kind of birthday drink do you want?
A beer.
A beer.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll take a white Russian and drink it with
a huge mug, like, you know, of at least 70 ounces.
Wow. My. So you might see Ray, but he might not notice you. Well, DLC.
I'll have okay. My beer goggles on. I'll probably be sober through the whole thing because I'll be working.
You will, because you'll be working. That's per the employee handbook, young man.
Yep.
All right. You guys have a wonderful week, and thank you for joining us.